everyone, and welcome to Heavy Pod is Heavycast, episode 88. And this week we have Eden back.
This is a very problematic episode number.
Oh.
Oh. had you considered that?
No, I had not. I mean, you know, there are a lot of problematic numbers, you know, like 69, 420.
Yeah, maybe we can do this episode 14 minutes long.
Ah, yeah. And, you know, we should give it like a title. I don't know. What should it call
it? Well, this will get us kicked off iTunes. This is the one where we finally get kicked off.
I think we should have like a minute of solidarity silence to respect the number of this episode and just call the episode SS because of the solidarity silence.
Jesus Christ. Okay, now we have to explain what we're talking about because this is sounding super weird.
Yeah, okay, you go ahead.
So 8-8 is like a numerical way to say SS without actually saying SS. Yeah. And it's commonly used by Nazis to kind of speak in code. Mm-hmm. And the 14-minute thing is a reference to the 14 words. Mm-hmm. We must secure the future, blah, 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 blah. And it's been getting a lot of heat recently because all sorts of prominent media figures like Ann Coulter, is that how you pronounce her last name?
Coulter.
And Sarah Palin have weaved the numbers into their speeches or whatever.
Yeah.
And you remember that Coulter, is she the one who had like that pseudo-Nazi salute?
Yeah, I think that was Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah, at the RNC. So...
Yeah.
And this is episode 88, so.
Yeah.
With two people who would have been exterminated under Nazi rule.
Okay, so speaking of Nazi rule.
Oh, God.
I don't have a segue here.
No, so. Luckily, we don't have a segue.
I have an update. So last week with Ahmed, we talked about Jay-Z doing some weird stuff with his album on exclusivity on Tidal.
Yeah.
And by the time, like within the 24 hours from the recording of and posting of that episode where we discussed, you know, Jay-Z's new album 444 being Tidal exclusive, but only if you signed up for Sprint at the, like, some bullshit like that. Go listen to that episode. I'm too tired to this one. Anyway, within that 24 hour window, Jay-Z actually made the album freely available outside of Tidal as long as you give him your email address.
So why was this a segue from the Nazi stuff? Just so.
Oh no, it was not a segue. It was an update, and me changing the subject with a hard 180 degree turn.
But there is a segue here because Jay-Z has some problematic lyrics on this album.
Arguably, some people are. So, of course. So when it comes to this, I mean, when it comes to kind of music in general, it's hard to say whether the artist is serious about this or like the song
genuine. I think genuine is the better word.
Yeah, genuine about this, and also the song is supposedly kind of, you know, set parodying a character, but of course it's hard to say if fanboys are just defending the artist versus, you know, because rap has a problem with anti-Semitism, and this has been like popped up with Kanye West as well, where in one of his more recent Man, why can't I talk today? In one of his new songs, Jay-Z says the Jews own everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the segue there. And some people are saying, you know, this is kind of the lyric is supposed to represent an asshole rich rapper who is being condescending. And I'm just saying, isn't that just Jay-Z?
And also, like, I super agree with the fact that I can't say the N-word, even if I'm quoting someone else. But like, if I was doing an impression of like a white supremacist, I would never say the N-word, even if I'm doing an impression, because it doesn't matter the context in which you use the word. The word is not mine to use. And I feel like the same thing here, like you can't, as a popular artist whose lyrics will be misinterpreted and misunderstood, and you can't take the risk that even one person doesn't understand, like, you know, the play, the sarcasm, the character you're playing, and will say, oh yeah, Jay-Z, who is a rapper that I really, really like, said that the Jews own everything, and then, you know, let me start researching this, and it fucking gets to Stormfront or whatever. You can't take that risk. A, and B, it's not funny. Like,
it's not supposed to be funny. It's supposed to be like criticizing the stereotype, apparently.
Yeah,
I don't really get it, but I don't really care either. So whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna be up in arms and saying boycott Jay-Z. I mean, it's not the point here. It's just for future. Just don't say. Just avoid.
It's especially problematic when considering like it is already kind of a problem within the rap community.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so on other news of Jay-Z and Tidal, and this episode we're going to discuss several music industry shenanigans. So yeah. This is the first one. So article title, this is from Forbes, Jay-Z's 444 goes platinum in 6 days thanks to Sprint. So basically what happened is that by gaming the Record Industry Association of America, the way they kind of calculate sales and platinums, essentially, Jay-Z used Tidal's deal with Sprint to make his new album go platinum. Because when the Sprint deal with Tidal goes through, essentially Sprint kind of puts a hold on a certain number of copies of the album, right? It kind of pre-buys them to be able to serve it to the customers. Mm-hmm. And when this happened, apparently, like, due to the way things are calculated, these held copies are considered actual purchased copies, apparently. So, and also the way he did like the email voucher thing that I mentioned, again, free email thing, that also counts as like held copies. So as a result, the album went platinum, even though no one actually bought it.
So I would like you to also introduce the second shenanigan, so that I can respond to both, because I have one thing to say about this entire thing.
Are we talking about the Kanye West thing?
Oh, so we have three. I'm talking about SoundCloud.
Oh, yeah. So this...
Not SoundCloud, and Spotify.
Oh, yes. Okay. So before the Spotify thing, I forgot to put this, but apparently Jay-Z and Kanye West had a falling out, and now one of them is suing the other over some Tidal-related stuff. Mm-hmm. So... kind of, you know, they were kind of a big part of the partnership that sold Tidal, and you know, Kanye's album last year was a huge draw for Tidal, but now they've fallen out. So there's that. And also Jay-Z's new album apparently like contains a diss towards Kanye. I don't know, I didn't really listen to all of it. But then here's the second thing. This is a really big story. So this is an article by Vulture, and they kind of, you know, put together other articles and kind of did a little bit of their own like math and stuff to figure this out. But basically the article called "The Streaming Problem: How Spammers, Superstars, and Tech Giants Game the Music Industry." And this is, even though it's called "The Streaming Problem," it's mainly talking about Spotify. Mm-hmm. So what happens is, and this is a pretty long article and it talks about several methods, but I'm going to try to boil it down. And essentially, so Spotify has these algorithms, right? These algorithms to keep track of what people listen to, you know, what people are interested in, and then it uses these algorithms to give payout to certain artists in a certain fashion. And
yeah,
Spotify's payout model has been criticized. We've talked about this on the podcast as well, but essentially, you know, what your listen does not go directly to the artists you listen. Your listens are kind of pooled and distributed to all artists ranked on how big they are. Kind of something like this is like a gross oversimplification, but what ends up happening here is that basically people put a lot of spam tracks on Spotify, like hundreds of different versions of Happy Birthday, and this lets them kind of game the system and get a lot more money than they would. And what really egregious is that this article cites another article that claims with very strong sources that essentially Spotify is paying producers to make fake music. And by fake music, I mean like generic, like, you know, generic chill or generic jazz and like generic birthday covers and whatnot to create this like non-music that people don't actually care to listen to by populating playlists. And due to some ways the algorithm is gamed, and I really recommend that you read the article. I'm obviously going to put a link to the article in the description because I don't want to like boil down too much, but essentially Spotify is paying producers to create fake music so that A, they get a bigger payout, and B, these producers also make money for making like shit music that is like super low effort. But essentially, Spotify is gaming the system. And after this article came out, you know, they've contacted Spotify. Spotify didn't respond. But Stereogum got in touch with Spotify. And Spotify said, no, we're not doing this. But of course, they would say that. But
yeah,
basically, like, it's a huge mess of making money from not from like legitimate listens by people, but by gaming Spotify's mathematical systems to inflate numbers and write themselves a paycheck.
Yeah. So here's what I have to say to both of those things. On a thread by Jimmy, the founder of Heavy Blog, it was kind of a stupid meme. Ask me about the top five, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I said top five podcast episodes. And someone commented sarcastically, the one where Eden gets all righteously angry.
Yeah.
So hold on to your fucking seat. because it's that time again, boys and girls. So this is what happens when you refuse to treat music as a business. This is the result of the music industry being all high and mighty and platonic and purist about music, because they refused to look at their music as a product. They refused to think about these things and how streaming and money and new business practices are going to change the way that people consume music. And in that vacuum, in that void, which wasn't populated by the people actually making music, corporates saw a jackpot, right? That's how corporations work. They see these gaps, they see these voids, and then they find a way to insert themselves. And they don't give a shit about the music. There's no such thing as fake music for Spotify or fake music for Sprint. I'm making a great leap here, which might be disproved by anecdotes like Martin Shkreli and his love for Wu-Tang Clan. But most of these executives, they don't listen to music on a daily basis. And you can be sure as hell that they don't listen to underground artists, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't care what sort of damage they do to this industry. All they care about is another paycheck, right?
Yeah.
Making profits for their companies. So by giving up on this field and focusing on your precious musical purity, you basically paved the way for this to happen, right? And now there's no counter argument, there's no counter effort, there's no one to resist these kind of things, because the field has been completely left to these companies. And you know what, this is only going to get worse. And if you think that like the fucking free market is going to regulate this, well, I got some news for you. It's not gonna happen. This is the free market.
Yes, this exactly
is how, this is how the free market fucking works. And if you're, by the way, if you talk about pure music and you're a capitalist, then this is what you believe in, right? This is companies that it's everything is legal. Everything they're doing here is completely legit. Nothing they do is legally wrong. It might be morally dubious, but there's no morals in a modern law system. And there's literally nothing you can do about them. Even if Spotify comes out and says, yeah, we did it, there's nothing you can do. It's not anything.
By the way, an update to something we talked about earlier. You remember how we talked about Spotify wasn't paying artists the money that they're owed? Mm-hmm. Not that the payments are low, but this was a separate story about how, you know, they were literally not paying artists. And there was a $200 million class action suit. That suit was settled earlier this month for $43 million.
Yeah. So, fuck. And again, like, just to stress the damage that's caused here. It dilutes the market and makes sure that underground artists, like a legit chillwave artist out there, gets pushed aside by their basic inability to release, you know, 20 albums within a month, which is what this one of these fake artists that are actually producers can definitely do. And it makes it harder for underground bands to get exposure. B, yeah. It tells these companies, because it succeeds, it tells them that they don't actually have to make a good product, right? They don't actually have to work on their UI and their algorithms and their targeting. They just have to find ways to game the system and work within the cracks. Like, we could have taught Sprint a different lesson. We could have taught Sprint that investing in underground music pays off. But instead, we taught them the lesson that conspiring with a washed out artist who's way past his prime and just gaming the system is the way to go. Is the way that you get popularity and you get your ROI. And this is all these companies care about. And the last thing is that every time this happens, it becomes harder to stop the next thing from happening.
Yeah.
Because it creates precedent, it creates a norm. And like in a year, if these things keep happening and these companies keep doing this, we won't even notice them doing it because there won't be an outcry. This is the same cycle, right?
Yep.
People care about it. It happens 5-6 times. Nobody does anything about it. And then it becomes part of the norm. And it's just, it's atrocious. And I my fear is that it's too late, right? It's too late to stop these giants, because what the fuck are you going to do against Sprint?
Yeah.
They're a huge company.
To clarify, like you mentioned, like this underground chillwave artist, right? What Spotify is doing is literally taking money away from this artist, because again, when you listen to this artist, your money is not going to go directly to this artist. Your money is going to be distributed amongst all artists in that category, and balanced by how much that artist's share has over the entire money pool. And when these fake artists are kind of populating that money pool, that share with garbage, the actual percentage that your legitimate artist gets is going to be reduced by the fake artist, and that fake artist is going to receive the money of the person who is not listening to them.
Yeah, I agree. And the last thing I want to add here is, how do I want to say this? Like, these mediums are inevitable. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not saying boycott streaming. Don't do streaming. I'm saying the opposite. Let's do streaming, but let's do it properly. Let's think about it. And the problem is that because Spotify and SoundCloud and YouTube, to an extent, were such groundbreaking services, people assume that they're good services. And this is something that happens all the time. You have the one progenitor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that it becomes the norm. And no one asks, wait, is this a good product? Do we need to innovate again? Is this what we want to be the litmus test for streaming products? And no one is asking these questions. And even if Spotify didn't do the fake artist thing, the fact that on their platform, and they condone and support it, there are the happy birthday stuff, fake covers of other songs that are meant to lure people into listening to them,
mm-hmm.
like Kendrick Lamar spinoffs that have a lyric from the song as their title, so that mm-hmm. people who don't know the name of the song get to that instead of Kendrick Lamar. The fact that that stuff is still on their platform and they don't have an effective way to delete those just shows stuff that they don't give a fuck.
Like, the more songs a producer has on Spotify, the more likely they are to come up in search results. So these like spam producers just like generate tons of fake songs so that they kind of up their ranking in the system, just like making the problem worse, because then you're more likely to see the results from this fake artist and kind of, you know, click on it. And especially if you have something like, I don't know, Jay-Z's new album, which is not on Spotify, and then someone goes and makes, what was the name of that track? The Story of OJ or whatever. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But like, if someone makes a fake song that has like similar, like sounds like that song, when you look at a list, then that is going to essentially just, you know, fake track stealing revenue.
Yeah. And of course, there's like a meta issue here with, in general, how these X as a service companies view their responsibility towards the product. You know, it's like Twitter saying, oh, we're not going to call the hate speech because it's just a platform, right? People can do whatever they want with it.
Or how Facebook videos are complete like a copyright mess, and people can just plagiarize whatever they want, take someone else's video, upload it, and you know, they will, if they're a bigger page, they will make more money from someone else's video.
Yeah. And it all boils down to, in the end, consumer complacency and people just not giving a shit about these things, not caring about copyright laws, not caring about the quality of the music streaming services that they get. And it's just it's a real shame. And as things go by, like, Twitter is worse than Facebook and Spotify is worse than Twitter, right? It keeps deteriorating.
Yeah.
And who knows, you know, what's next.
And let me give a to be fair here. Technologically speaking, this problem is very difficult to solve, right?
Yeah, because, 100%.
And to be fair to Google, for example, they are putting a lot of effort into kind of how do we automatically find duplicates? How do we automatically, you know, figure out this thing? And it is a tough problem, like, especially when you have like things that are almost right but wrong, but you know, just right enough in the ways to fool the algorithms. Like,
yeah,
you know, because the people making this fake shit also know how the algorithms work. So it's a hard problem. And some companies are trying harder than the others. Like Twitter doesn't give a shit, but Google is kind of trying. But again, like it is, they're not trying hard enough, and it's not necessarily just an algorithm problem. It's also a policy problem. And a lot of the times that's where kind of things fall apart.
And I think Facebook is also a good example. You know, it really shows that they took two things to heart. One, the accusations of their complacency in the whole fake news phenomena. Mm-hmm. And they founded a whole editorial body that like reviews news articles and stuff like that, and a new reporting system for that stuff. And also the second thing, which I know from like people who were at the Facebook offices and did some research into this stuff, the whole people getting murdered on Facebook Live.
Yeah.
And people hurting themselves on Facebook Live, that really shook people within the Facebook organization. And they are trying to fix it. But again, it's this question of, you know, the famous Facebook policy is move fast and break things. And then you move fast, you get product out there, stuff breaks, and then you go back and you fix it.
They don't necessarily care about this for humanitarian reasons. They care because it hurts their ability to earn revenue from advertisers
bad content.
Yeah, the advertisers don't like their ads being shown on like videos of people getting murdered.
Yeah. So, but putting that aside, because we can only speculate about their motivation, what I'm saying is once it becomes move fast and break people, I think that's where the line needs to be drawn, right? You're not breaking a feature. You're not breaking a database. You're breaking people's lives. And even if it's not the murder thing, let's go back to Spotify. Like, you're fucking with people's careers and source of income. And once you become not a monopoly, but like a given, a fact of the industry, then you have more responsibility than a dime a dozen company.
Yeah.
That was my righteous anger for this episode, hopefully.
And now, another bad news from the other side of things. And this is that SoundCloud lays off 40% of staff in an effort to stay independent. So this, we kind of saw this coming.
Yeah.
Last year, you know, they were in problems, and Spotify was apparently considering buying them. And they don't seem to be one to bought. So they had to downsize significantly. 40% is a very large number.
Oh,
They had 420 people, which is interesting. And they are firing 173 of them. And SoundCloud, again, like they're having a hard time monetizing their service. And they also have problems with copyright. And it's a shame because SoundCloud, SoundCloud always seemed like a platform that actually kind of gave a shit.
Yeah.
To some extent, like their purpose was to kind of elevate artists. And it sucks.
And I mean, it's a shame also because really we want these platforms to succeed.
Yeah.
We use streaming services every day. And we really are rooting for these companies because we recognize that they're the future of how people consume music.
I don't want Jay-Z to fail. Tidal succeeding would be a good thing. But like, I don't want it to succeed by scamming artists or like having shitty policies that screw over the customers. Yeah. That's why we're mad.
So SoundCloud, I've never liked their platform. Their UI is not good in my experience. And they also have like a really terrible mobile app. But yeah, I'm totally rooting for them. And this news is troubling.
SoundCloud is really good for like electronic music and remixes and mashups and stuff.
Yeah. Because it's also trap, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
electronic music.
Yeah.
Like, you know, DJs put out a lot of stuff on SoundCloud. Like you can easily put up like a single, a mixtape on SoundCloud. The barrier is super low and you can easily reach people. And it's like, the mobile app isn't necessarily great, but it's still like a pretty convenient platform for listening. Yeah, like
it functions.
Yeah. And like it functions than anything else that has the same level of access for the creator.
Yeah. And so it's a good thing for there to be multiple streaming services out there.
Yeah.
If we get just two or three big companies, you know, that's the only competition, then we'll wind up in like how the phone market was like 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's improving because you get like smaller companies, but that was a big problem. So it's not good if SoundCloud closes. It's not a good thing.
Yeah. It's interesting though. We haven't really heard any kind of shitstorm stories about Apple Music. And in fact, I just looked it up, and apparently it's like they're making more money now. Like they're actually doing better than they used to. It's on the upswing. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Apple Music has the advantage of Apple. I mean, that
the service, biggest tech company in the world.
Yeah, exactly. And that service, A, they have access to so many users. Mm-hmm. And B, they have access to users who like using apps from the same company and mm-hmm. often don't have a choice, right? Because they have an iPhone. And
you can use Spotify on an iPhone.
No, I mean, you have less. I mean, I'm not an Android fanboy or an iPhone hater, but one of the big disadvantages of iPhone is it supports less apps and it's heavily tilted towards Apple designed software. Or do you disagree?
Not worth getting into it. You're right in some ways, but like it's just too minor of a nitpick to whatever. Continue. Yeah.
So, in any case, and lastly, and this is the big thing, the service can be non-profitable for years.
Yeah, exactly.
And the company will absorb it, right?
Yeah.
And then they can.
Because can be a loss leader. That's the whole point, right? Like, yeah, Spotify can't necessarily be a loss leader because then they just go bankrupt.
Yeah. And here they can just try this. It doesn't work. Try another thing. You know, YouTube is a perfect example. Once Google bought them, they tried a million things that failed completely, but they're still there because fucking Google, you know?
Yeah. And like, you know, you can just spin up a new department because you already have the tech folk to do it. And you can just be like, you know, you need to hire way less people to do a thing. Like very convenient.
Have I told the story of Google's voice recognition on the podcast?
I'm not sure.
So Google, way back in the previous decade, had this service where you would call an actual number and ask for directions. I think this is like when smartphones were starting out, and it was a fucking mess, you know, because people would call in and would say, I want to go to Springfield, Missouri, and they'd say Missouri weird, right, because they have an accent, and it would send them to Maryland or whatever. And it was a complete failure, and people ridiculed Google for it. But what they didn't consider is that Google just collected tons and tons of data on how people speak. And that was actually the basis for the code that made Android's voice recognition software possible. They used like the shit ton of recordings of people speaking and saying place names to build what is now their quite celebrated voice recognition system. So that's how huge tech companies, you know, when they say too big to fail, that's kind of what happens here. Because even if they fail, they get so much data that it just gets reincarnated in the next project.
And that's especially true of Google, but because that is literally they actually operate that way.
Yeah, that's what they do.
I'm surprised that Google hasn't had like a decent streaming music service alternative to like Spotify or Apple Music.
I mean, you have Google Play, but it's kind of like a cloud solution. No.
I take that back. YouTube Red is what they're trying to kind of position as that.
Yeah. I haven't really checked it out. I mean, it's not available outside of the States, I think.
Oh, okay.
Still. But yeah, the day that they start to, you know, they decide to launch it globally and try and take that market on, that will be very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
That concludes the streaming service shenanigans.
Tech blog is tech.
Yeah. We are also a metal site.
Are we?
Are we? Yeah, I don't know.
Metal sucks anyway. Do you get it? The reference? The guys? Yeah, the other guys?
Yeah, those guys. Who guys?
Those guys. The guys who own us.
Kind of, actually?
Kind of, yeah. No, I was only half joking.
Yeah. Well, I guess we clarify for the listener, but like we are on an advertising network that helps pay our bills, and Metal Sucks are another partner in that service.
I mean, they're more than a partner.
Yeah.
They're kind of the founders.
Well, you know, if you found something and partner with others, you're still a partner.
Yeah. The Last Beat Network, by the way. That's the
name. Yes. Thing.
And we like it, by the way. It's overall, it's a good service. It gives you like metal tailored ads.
Yes. And like I complain a lot about ads. Like I think ads are horrible, but given that they're a necessary evil, at least the fact that we have accountability on this ad network is a big deal. Because like when you buy ads from Google, there is way less accountability. Whereas if we are part of the, we are part of the company that serves the ads, then we need to be responsible. So that actually, you know, that means that we need to care actually about the ads we put on the site.
And you get ads that are not like, this one game is driving the world crazy, blah, 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 blah. And then it's like a World of Tanks ripoff. It's like actual albums and concerts and t-shirts and stuff that you actually care about.
At least it tries its best, like 80% of the time.
Yeah.
Because sometimes tech reasons, the data is not available. It's actually a really complicated, fascinating thing, but I don't think there's point in getting into that here.
Music.
Okay, so the Artspire single Involuntary Doppelganger actually came out this week, like we mentioned it before, and it's amazing. I guess since everybody kind of brings this up, it's worth bringing up that, you know, there was a Metal Sucks article a while back about the vocalist of Artspire making some super edgy, shitty comments back in the day, like a couple of years ago when the Bataclan shooting happened. And I would say that that is awful, and I do not want to support his comments. But, and you know, we always talk about where do we draw the line with artists. But it sucks that this is the thing in metal, because like if you like draw a hard, and you know, everybody's feel free to draw their own line at their own where they're comfortable, right? So I don't want to kind of preach to tell people to kind of, oh, it's no big deal, you just accept, right? I don't want to do that. But it sucks that in metal there's so many of these types of people. That, like, if I really wanted to draw a hard line, I would be unable to listen to, like, I don't know, 80% of bands.
And I'm gonna, like, and in different flavors as well, because there's the American type of shitty opinions, which is usually stuff like this, you know, like edgelord politics shit.
9/11 truthers.
Exactly. And then there's the European version of it, which is usually just, you know, and again, I'm sorry, but the casual racism of Europeans is just, it's so ingrained into their culture, you know, like superiority of places over other places, that you would just wipe out, like, you know, folk metal, don't listen to any of it. Because the chances are that if not someone in the band, like someone they know is a fucking Nazi or whatever. So
deathcore just, you know, nuke the entire genre.
So again, you know, and we had some internal discussion over it. It's a question where you draw the line. And I feel that in this case, A, the opinions are shitty, but they're not institutionalized, right? It's not this guy who has an ideology of, you know, racism or misogyny or, you know, hate on victims of shootings and stuff like that. It's just some guy saying flippant, idiotic
jokes.
White male jokes.
Yeah.
Right? That's one. Two, the rest of the band are, you know, I couldn't find anything on them. They're kind of just there. So it's not like the band, and they don't write about it, right? It's not like you listen to an Oxfam song and it's all about how the Bataclan victims deserved what they got.
Exactly. And, you know, that's, I think that is a significant, like, milestone in where people choose to draw their lines. Because when, you know, you can easily say that, oh, you know, the guy who makes it is an asshole, but the music is good and I don't care. So, I, you know, a lot of people draw their line there. But if it actually is reflected in their music, you know, it's a lot harder to stomach some white supremacist singing about ethnic genocide versus a white, like an edgelord singing about like dreamscapes and aliens and shit. Because there it doesn't really reflect in the music. And that sounds like a cop out to some, presumably. And sure, yeah, I admit that. But again, it really sucks that we have to play this game of racist chicken, like I said on in another thread. Like, you know, we were discussing some black metal band. I don't know if you were out for the concert during that thread, so I don't know if you got to catch it. But like, I was discussing this black metal band, and I don't want to name them. But like, you know, over their career, they've had, like, they have some super edgy, super anti-Semitic sounding material, but they've also had, like, rabbis on their material and, like, spoken against Nazis. Like, what the fuck? And they used to be on a white supremacist label. Like, what the fuck? Like, I don't, it's I don't like doing this, right? I don't want to go like pour through a band's interviews and like lyrics and song titles and like history to figure out if I'm fucking supporting a Nazi. I don't want people to be Nazis. Like, fucking
yeah. God. And sometimes it's really, really hard. Like, even if there's no back and forth, everything is just fuzzy. We spoke about this before. What's his name? Former Alcest.
Nej,
yeah, right. He's had like super problematic side projects. Or the guy from Drutk, right? The Ukrainian guy. What's his name?
Fuck. I don't know. Whatever.
Whatever. So, like, side projects. And then he was like 19, you know, and it's been 30 years. So, like, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and like, that's the passage of time. So, like, Dragon Force, I don't know if you know about this, but like, Dragon Force, before Dragon Force, they had like an ironic, like, racist band, right? But like, Herman Lee is in the fucking band. And like, I had him on the podcast. I specifically asked him about this, and he said he's obviously against racism. He says it fucking sucks. And like, but you know, it was like an edgy, stupid thing they did like 20 plus years ago. Like, you know?
Yeah. So I want to segue here. Speaking of,
sorry, before I say that, the Art Spy track is fucking amazing. And
oh yeah,
interestingly, this track sounds a lot like their previous album. And you know, that might lead some people to think, oh, you know, it's just going to be Lucid Collective 2.0. But no, the rest of the album is super interesting. It's like a lot more progressive and has a lot weirder ideas.
It's more melodic as well.
Yeah, like less melodic abrasive. In the Jarzombekian sense, I guess.
Yeah.
Sure. Really weird and really interesting, so definitely worth being excited for.
Yeah.
If you don't mind that the vocalist is an edgelord.
And if you do, that's fine.
Yeah.
So speaking of complex issues that have shitty solutions,
yes.
This festival in Sweden announced that they're going to do, in the wake of, like, in response to a wave of, like, sexual assaults in Sweden, there will be Sweden's first all-female music festival in 2018.
So, I want to preface this. I want to preface our remarks here. So, usually when you say something online about, oh, we want to make an all-female thing like the Wonder Woman screening party, right? The response immediately that you're going to get is, oh, what about men? And like, everybody arguing against it comes from this place of misogyny, and they're just trying to, you know, derail the conversation. And I want to preface this by saying that is not what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, for sure. So this festival, Bravala, billed as the biggest music festival in Sweden, cancelled. And that came after 4 rapes and 23 sexual assaults that allegedly took place on site during the 3-day event. So they canceled 2018. And then in the wake of that cancellation, like we said earlier, someone saw a void and stepped in. Emma Kincaire, I guess you pronounce her last name. And she tweeted about this and it kind of snowballed. So given your prefix, first of all, this is fine. It's
in theory.
I'm not against them doing this. Like, I'm not
the
saying-
I want to say this is fine, but I really want to clarify that when you say all women festival, you want to really think about what you mean when you say woman, right? In terms transgender representation.
Yeah, there's like a few problems I want to break down. I'm just saying, first of all, like a prefix to your prefix. Or suffix to your prefix. Any criticism that we are leveraging doesn't mean don't do this. We're not gonna go to people and say do this or not.
But and we're two dudes, so who cares about us?
Exactly. Our opinions are kind of irrelevant here. But here's some point of consideration that we had as part of an internal discussion. So one, like you said very correctly, all women. That's problematic. You need to consider what you mean when you say women, and like, will you screen people at the entrance? And then what about, and I hate this term, I hate it, but there's not a better term for it, non-passing trans folk, right?
Yes.
Trans folk who don't traditionally conform with the way that women are portrayed by society. Will you stop them at the door? And if not, how will you make that sort of distinction? And that just opens you to all sorts of terrible things, and it has a massive potential for TERFism, right?
Yes.
So that's one.
Trans exclusionary radical female feminism,
yes,
right?
Feminism, yeah. And the second thing here is, okay, so this is fine, but does this solve the problem, or does this get us closer to solving that problem or discussing it in an intelligent way? Like, this is not applicable on a grander scale. The problem is not that females and males co-inhabit the same festival. The problem is fucking rape culture, and yes, that female people cannot feel safe in a male environment. That is the problem. We cannot create female-only festivals on a global or even on a Swedish scale, right? So this kind of avoids the problem, because obviously removing all males from female environments is impossible.
So, and also, yeah, it kind of passes the blame in terms of, like, if you cannot hold a festival where you can guarantee the safety of the attendees, then don't fucking hold a festival.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Like, this is a security issue. This is a planning issue. Maybe you didn't put enough money into it. Maybe you didn't think about it. But the reaction, also the reaction of canceling before the all-female festival, like saying, you know what, our festival was a mess this year, people got raped and sexually assaulted, we're just not going to have it like next year. No, that's not a solution. The solution is to say, let's have a fucking discussion about this. Let's figure out how we're going to make this better. And the last thing I want to say here, like all people, female people want to be in the company of many types of people, right? Yep. Male people, non-binary people, trans people. Like, humans crave diversity. Humans crave, you know, decent humans. They crave being in the presence of other people. And the solution is not to fucking segregate, you know, festivals. Yeah. And it's just a quick way, I feel, to gain cultural capital, to gain headlines, without really facing the problem and looking it right between the eyes, to quote Mike Portnoy, whom I saw last week. And one last thing here, sorry, one addendum. This is especially important in Sweden.
Yeah.
Which has a history of covering up sexual assaults.
Yes.
Because they were committed by refugees and the problematic political stance. And we spoke about this when it happened. Or proximate to when it happened on the cast. And it's a whole fucking wasp's nest that we won't open now, but especially
the thing, like, by doing this you're avoiding, like, talking about more complicated versions of the problem, be it, you know, do we want to talk about the, you know, the refugee thing, or do we want to talk about the transgender thing, or do we want to talk about festival security, or do we want, like, this is just saying, okay, you know what, fuck this, let's just do this. And this doesn't solve any problems. This, you know, it creates a woman-only festival. That's fine. Nice. Good. Like, you know, that's a cool thing. That should happen. But you can't just do this without actually participating in the conversation.
Yeah. 100%. So, yeah, this is, it's not a bad move. Like you said, it should happen, but it's not enough. It's not going to solve the situation. It's not going to bring us closer to a solution or to a safer society. And it's just, honestly, another missed opportunity in this long track record of music's terrible treatment of sexual assault.
Also, I just want to say that, like, the post the person made on their Instagram describes it as Sweden's first man-free rock festival instead of Sweden's first, like, you know, women's rock festival. Like, it's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't care. Like, whatever. If you want to have it, have it. But, like, talk about these issues, because this, like, this doesn't make rape culture go away.
Yep. 100%. So, do I want to segue into another festival here?
Yeah, you mentioned Portnoy. You spoke to Portnoy. How did that happen? Tell us about it, Eden.
I didn't speak to Portnoy. I saw Portnoy playing. So,
I thought you said you spoke to, okay,
sorry. Quoting Portnoy from one of his tracks, you know, look the problem right between the eyes, part of the 12-step suite.
Hmm.
Let's stare the problem right in the eye. Whatever. I'm sorry for butchering that part. So, I was at BPOG, my friend. as Vincent Kavanaugh from Anathema put it on stage, it's an amazing festival with some of the best curation around, but it has the most terrible name. He actually said it on stage. It was amazing. So this festival
is... Why, man, don't you like prog memes?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of prog snob. if anyone running that page is listening right now, go fuck yourself. I honestly despise that page. So this festival is kind of cool. It's very young. I think 2013 or 14 was their first year, and they're focused on just progressive music.
Mm-hmm.
So the lineup this year...
Define progressive music.
Oh, God. So actually, the lineup is pretty indicative of that, because there's very little banding these bands together. Yeah. So I'll start from the smallest to the biggest. And that's... So first we had Caligula's Horse from Australia. Mm-hmm. Great band. We love them on the blog. Really cool, like melodic progressive metal.
Cheers, mate.
Sorry?
Cheers, mate.
Oh, God. This is the episode where we get kicked off iTunes. So, and then you had Jardin de la Croix, which is a local scene that has a lot of local fans, instrumental rock music. They were pretty good. Nothing to write home about, but for a local band, you saw that it was kind of like a big thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty good. And then you had Animals as Leaders, which was nice. It's not my favorite band in the world. You know, whenever they played something from Weightless, mm-hmm, I had a really good time.
Their first two albums are really fun live. The second two albums, not so much.
Yeah.
Except for one, it's two songs from Joy of Motion are also fun live. I forget the names, but yeah.
Yeah. And Tosin has really good charisma on stage, mm-hmm, and lots of people there were like super fans. So the crowd was very, very receptive to that. And then after Animals as Leaders, we had Devin Townsend mm-hmm, performing Ocean Machine back to back. And so it was a good show. It started off with a ton of technical problems. Their computer crashed.
I believe I saw footage of this on YouTube where he was like trying to entertain the crowd.
Yeah, he was doing like a stand-up show and mm-hmm, it kept going on and on. So he's running out of bits. It was like
15 minutes.
Yeah, and he needs to improvise. So he did like covers of Lynyrd Skynyrd songs, and he told really terrible dad jokes. And, you know, it's Devin. If anybody can pull this off, it's him. So, like, 5 minutes before they actually went on, he kind of lost the crowd and people were starting to get kind of grouchy. But then they played. And so I enjoyed the show because Ocean Machine is a great album. And I got to see, like, some of my favorite tracks from it live. Like, I saw Funeral live, which was incredible. So emotional. You know.
Much emotion. Such incredible.
What is this, 2006?
Be prog, my friend. Come on.
And Bastard the Night. Really good tracks. But I really wanted to see stuff from the rest of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't get the chance to do that. Luckily, he's playing Israel in September. So he'll do like an actual show.
So he supports the occupation?
He does support the occupation. Devin Townsend is a tanky right-wing fascist.
If you go back a few episodes, you'll understand that joke.
Yeah. Okay, so then I'm kind of losing the running order here. I'm
going from memory. Just tell me about Ulver. How was that? Fuck the running order.
Yeah, I actually didn't see Ulver live.
Okay, move on. Tell me about Leprous.
I was destroyed. So, let me tell you about Mike Portnoy's The Shattered Fortress.
Okay.
So, this is basically Haken
mm-hmm,
playing with Mike Portnoy. And the thing here, in contrast to Devin, which is why I wanted to talk about it now, is that they didn't just play the 12-step suite.
Mm-hmm.
They also did like Dream Theater Greatest Hits. Mm-hmm. Mostly stuff from scenes. So they had Overture, and then Finally Free. All
the
Free. Good
songs Portnoy has the rights to.
Exactly. And they did Finally Free. And then they did the 12-step suite. And it was really, 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 really good. For a few reasons. First of all, Ross, the singer for Haken, it's fucking uncanny. Like, if I looked away and heard him, it was James LeBrie.
I saw, like, one live song from a while earlier, and he didn't sound super on point, but maybe he got better.
Yeah, so when I saw him, he was really on point. And, you know, those are difficult parts. And it also takes a lot of stamina. So he had another singer kind of work with him when he needed rest. Mm-hmm. And obviously, Mike fucking Portnoy, you know, like that guy really holds the crowd within his hand. Like he does like putty within the hands of the creator. He can do whatever the fuck he wants with the crowd. And people were super responsive and everybody was chanting all the parts and stuff like that. It was really, really moving. And, you know, I never thought I'd get to see these songs live with Portnoy.
Especially with this configuration, right?
Exactly. And like the simulacra that Haken created of Dream Theater was very, very effective.
Mm-hmm.
They even, I know it wasn't intentional, but like the bass player was barely audible in the mix and he had hair covering his face in the entire audience. It was basically Myung, right?
You know what they should do? I think Portnoy should take this lineup and record the 12-step suite.
Yeah, and release it as an album.
Yep.
Okay, so that's Portnoy.
Yeah.
And now you wanted Lepus.
Yeah.
They were fucking incredible. They were the closing act. Mm-hmm. And because it was the second day and I didn't have to get up super early in the day, I actually stayed for it. That's why I didn't see Ulver. Because the day after it, I had to wake up like super early. So first of all, let's talk about the set list.
Mm-hmm.
And Einar mentioned this on stage. Like they're going to play tracks that they haven't played in a while.
Mm-hmm.
So they played Indifferentia from Tall Poppy. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time they've played it since 2013.
Mm-hmm.
From the Flame, which
is... Well, Indifferentia is from Bilateral.
Oh, Bilateral, sorry. My bad. And then From the Flame, which is from the new one, right?
Yep.
It's the first time they played it live.
Mm-hmm.
And then they fucking closed before the encore with Contaminate Me.
Oh, God.
And the funny thing is, Isan was actually in town because Emperor played the same night. So I was really hoping they would do like a guest, like a cameo, but it didn't happen. And Einar did the closing growls.
Mm-hmm.
And you could really see how much it took from him.
Yeah. Like,
that fucking screeching part at the end was so good. And the encore was Slave, which was really cool. And then, you know, seeing the classics like The Valley, Forced Entry, The Cloak, Rewind, stuff like that. But they had really great energy. And the thing for me...
Yeah, this is random, but I mentioned this in our group, but like this was a super weird discovery to me. So we know Isan's real name is Vegard Sverretveitan.
Yeah.
And he's worked with his wife on, you know, several musical projects. And I your name is Heidi Solberg Tveitan, right? And I'm like, wait a second. And
Solberg.
Yeah, and she's Einar Solberg's sister.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why the bands always hang out and work together.
Yeah, and I mean, Lepus were Emperor for a time, right? They were Isan's backing band.
Yep.
And again, for me, it was kind of like a melancholy concert, not just because of the music, but also because I'd heard the first album, the new album, which we discussed, and like, The gap between the live presence and the stuff on the album just made it even more lackluster.
Yeah.
Because they had so much energy and so much power on stage. And like, what the fuck is that on the album?
Was the new song better live?
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
But that's not a surprise. Like, I had a few beers and there was a crowd like screaming the words.
Yeah, I also listened to Cole earlier today and like, what the fuck happened, man?
Yeah. So I'm going to do the two worst bands and then the last band. I'm going to save the meme for last. So Marillion and Jeffotal. So these guys are like the headliners of the festival. And yeah. I can understand that because they're super like old school and very respected bands.
Yeah.
So let's start from not so
do
bad
we have
to terrible. I just want to say a few things and okay. I'll make it short. So Jeffotal were not so bad. The thing was though, Ian Anderson is so... in love with himself. And he's so harping on nostalgic stuff. Like, every single piece of banter in the show was, this album we released in 67, way before Led Zeppelin ever recorded, blah, 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 blah. Like, how they were the progenitors of Prog. He even went on to say...
Progenitors.
Oh, God. God damn it. Okay, guys, it's been a good one.
Thank you for listening.
Next week. Bye-bye. And then silence. Okay, yeah. So he was like, this song, maybe if we hadn't recorded it, there wouldn't even be a B-Prog festival because there wouldn't be progressive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, No, dude. I'm pretty sure that Rush and Yes are way bigger than you. And yeah. Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin are much bigger than you. So it kind of just ruined the entire feeling of the set. And they also did like really long improvised versions of songs. Like they played Aqualung, but I didn't hear Aqualung because it was all like, here's a solo. And it's like a solo that's not on the album and then another yeah. solo and another solo. It was just a mess. And Marillion were even worse. Have you heard Marillion ever?
Not in ages.
Don't. They're like this 80s over the top art rock thing.
Yeah, I know, but like
so bad. It really didn't carry. They seemed very lackluster and like all their drama, you know, their singer in this white suit, you know, this like Elton John kind of aesthetic,
mm-hmm.
looking lost and mysterious on stage. It was just terrible. And that's all I have to say about this because I honestly didn't even listen. It was so bad.
You didn't listen to Oliver, but you listened to these.
So I was trying to make it to Oliver, but then it's like close to like midnight. We were all just so destroyed. And it was an hour until Oliver even went on. And we were waking up at like 8. So we had to skip it.
It's okay, man.
Last thing. Anathema.
Yep.
I mean, I've seen Anathema before. I saw them at Download Festival, but they played like a short set. And this was a full Anathema set, and it was so fucking good. It was just incredible. One of the best live shows I've seen. The energy was amazing. The set list was amazing. They did stuff from all of their, almost all of their, you know, like post-transformation records. And their sound was so good. Their drummer live, Daniel Carduso, is really, really good. And Lee Douglas, the singer, she was just so on point. And the crowd, that's what I wasn't expecting. The crowd was really into it and knew all the lyrics and shit like that. So it was just an amazing, probably the best show in the festival. And overall, I really had a good time. Barcelona is a great city. It's really cool that the festival starts in the afternoon. So you can like walk around and do touristy mm-hmm. shit. And the festival itself was small. I would say there's like 1,500 people.
That's pretty small.
Yeah, that enables them to be really tight with organization. So it wasn't too dirty and it was nice to walk around and the place itself was very central. So overall, it was a great experience and I'm looking forward to going back next year.
Cool.
And that's it.
You're going to be Prague next year as well.
I'm always Prague, dude.
That's your secret?
That's my secret. Oh, God. Oh, God. That's literally like, I'm pretty sure there was a Prague snob meme. Literally God. That.
Was it in 4-4?
Probably.
Okay. Wow, it's almost an hour mark. Do you want to keep going?
Yeah, like, yeah, let's do it. Let's okay. finish the news.
Sure, make the segues. I'm checked out.
So the opposite of checked out. That's encouraging.
I'm
so
kidding.
When I came back from the festival, I needed palate cleansers mm-hmm. because I had heard nothing but like super melodic progressive. So I made a thread in staff saying, give me all your Dark Descent core, dirty ass death metal.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of a trend that's happening now, right? It's kind of very lo-fi, mm-hmm. dark, blackened death metal, spearheaded by Dark Descent Records. If you're not aware of them, just search the blog. We had a really good interview with them.
We talked about them on the podcast too.
Yeah. And then I came across this record, obviously from Australia.
But this is not Dark Descent itself.
Not Dark Descent. Yeah, it's on Blood Harvest by a band called Contaminated. And the release is called Final Man. Like the cover is, you know, this old school death metal cover,
mm-hmm.
like a space horror kind of shit. And it's just the dirtiest death metal I've heard in a long time.
Yep.
Super lo-fi, fuzzy-ass death metal, and I really like it.
And it doesn't sound like shit either. Like, sure, it's lo-fi in a sense, but it's also like modern lo-fi. It doesn't sound like actual garbage.
Yeah, you can actually make out like the different notes and shit like that. And the vocalist does a really good job. And overall, like I really enjoy this movement. I shouldn't. You know, it's not like my usual thing.
Mm-hmm.
But Father Befouled is a really good band doing this right now. And there's a bunch of other bands from Dark Descent that I really, really enjoy. So yeah, check out the stuff if you like really dirty, dirty music.
If they don't like that, what should they check out instead?
Stargazer. Nice, nice alley-oop. I like that. so these guys, and we just had that thread about post-hardcore and metalcore. Mm-hmm. These guys do like melodic metalcore, you know, between the Buried and Me core, basically. But they're actually good. And they fell off the map. They had like an EP. Yeah, that was a subtle dig. So they had this EP in 2013 called Genesis. And then they kind of vanished. And now they're back. And they have a new track called The Dream Electric. And mm-hmm. it's really good. It like manages to be very off the genre. So you have like over the top melodic clean vocals and chuggy guitars and shit like that and synths. But it manages to be very fresh. I'm very over this genre. Mm-hmm. But this track is getting me hyped. And they're releasing a new album called Tui La. Not sure when it's releasing, but check this out if this is what you want and not lo-fi abrasive death metal.
Yep. And also, this week, there's the new Blind Guardian Live album is out.
Yeah.
I forget what it's called, but who cares? It's the Blind Guardian Live album. I think it's the third. And it's probably my least favorite out of their live albums because yeah. I think the set list is pretty weak. There's a bunch of Nightfall stuff, and I don't really like Nightfall that much. There is two great tracks from the new album, The Ninth Wave and Twilight of the Gods, or whatever that one's called.
Yeah. And like, I'm looking at Live, the live album they released in 2003.
That's amazing.
It's just a perfect playlist. Like, yes. Welcome to Dying, Nightfall, Into the Storm, Harvest of Sorrow, Valhalla, Majesty.
Mordred Song, Bright Eyes.
Born in the Morning Hall. Bright Eyes, like you said, Bard Song, obviously. Imaginations on the Other Side, Past and Future Secret, Mirror Mirror, like, holy shit, this is
the unofficial dream. Fan name for that is Bard's Tavern, that album.
That's a really cool name. And I just saw them live in Israel before mm-hmm. I flew to the festival. Holy fuck, it was so good. How does Hansi sing like that? How? He's so old
by
now.
I was actually going to complain about that because, especially on the new album, there are a lot of like really high vocal lines. And mm-hmm. he does the low harmonies on them instead live these days, which is understandable, right?
He did that as well in Israel, but instead of copying out, he like owns it. He says, okay, yes. I can't do these high notes anymore, but I'm really gonna nail these like low growls.
Yeah.
So for me, it worked.
Like he does not half-ass doing the low end, the low harmonies. He like really puts effort into them. And I can respect that, but it's also kind of disappointing, I guess, in a sense, because like especially on the way the album is mixed, the high vocals are super emphasized and they're like the big driving moments, so it's kind of so I was mildly excited for this album, but other than like those two songs, I don't really love the rest, and the Bard's Tavern is overall better, so I would rather just make a playlist out of the Bard's Tavern plus the two new songs.
Well, is our Beyond the Red Door remastered? That's what I want to know.
Yeah,
I need that album. Someone get the stems and just completely produce this album from scratch.
Yep. It's good to have like a version of those songs where you can actually hear the guitars.
Yeah. Terrible.
All right.
Are we going to do that?
Yeah, we can do that. I was just going to say, I don't think there's enough time to go into the whole Devin Townsend thing part 3. So instead, let's talk about Mastodon. I don't know. Like I was listening to Shuffle randomly, and like something from Mastodon came on, and I was like, "Man, this album fucking aged well," and like there's still nothing else like it.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like if not the best Gent album, then definitely top 3.
Yeah,
it's just incredible, and the shame, you know, the shame is that the follow up wasn't as good. But maybe there's like rumblings in the Vildjarta camp.
They keep putting out teasers and like random things. Yeah, clearly they want to do something, but who knows what's going on there.
Just Mastodon like nailed that ambient djent tone
mm-hmm.
in a way that maybe only Febrous by an Even Structure ever has.
But this has like an even more unique thing with the super weird riffing that's almost like borderline mildly influenced by stuff like Gorguts.
Yeah, I agree. It's a lot more technical than Febrous. Mm-hmm. And it also has incredible flow. Like, the album doesn't fucking stop. Even the ambient passages are just a setup for the next, like, huge riff that hits you in the face.
And I really like that when there's ambience, it's usually, like, sinister ambience, which djent bands don't do enough of. It's usually, like, this mellow, like, spacey bam type of thing, whereas these guys, like, make it sound really sinister.
Yeah, they use the guitar in a really interesting way during the ambient passages.
Mm-hmm.
That, as you said, like ominous, right? Something coming for you.
Yeah.
And in general, that's like another strong point of the album, the aesthetic.
Yeah.
The cover art and the way that it works with the ambience is really cool. It like draws you into this heartland, which, you know, that's the name of the album, Mastodon.
Mm-hmm.
It draws you into this place. And honestly, there aren't any bad tracks on this album. Like, The Closer is fucking amazing, Lonely Ranger. But, yep, like, Dagger, Eternal Golden Monk, Traces.
I actually don't like Traces. I feel
you don't like Traces?
Yeah, because it feels like it's a track from a regular djent band.
I like it within the context. Like, it's really... It reminds me of Textures in a way.
Exactly. That's why I don't like... Like, I don't dislike... I like Trace Textures, but I feel like it's the most odd one out song on the album.
Yeah. I don't know. I like it within the context because it's, like, refreshing to hear them doing something straightforward after the rest of it. But yeah, no, I can respect that opinion. So yeah,
a lot of people like that song, but like that's the I particularly dislike it because of that.
Yeah, I feel like it's definitely not my favorite song on the album.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoy it, and like you said,
it's also really long.
Yeah, it's really long. As you said at the onset of this discussion, this album is aged so well. Like a lot of the stuff from this period, even stuff that I like, you know, Februus, for example, mm-hmm. it's one of my all-time favorite albums. But I need to be in a very specific mood to listen to it, right? Because I'm just like, oh, right, this part, 3 minutes of like weird ambience. I wonder how that's going to sound in the recording. like weird ambience. I'm like, okay, can we get to Hail? Can we get to that part yeah. I really like? But with Mastodon, I put it on because you pointed it out and it was like nonstop chair dancing. Like
yep.
Nonstop headbanging. It's really, really aged well.
Yep. Just wanted to point that out for no cool. reason, really.
Cool people time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spider-Man.
Oh, yes.
Spider-Man was amazing.
Yes, it was. It really, really was. Really good movie. So let me go for my favorite things about it. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to agree with the first one. The guy playing Spider-Man.
Tom Holland. He's British, fucking... apparently.
Oh, really? Wow. His accent is really good.
Yeah.
He fucking knocked it out of the park.
Yes, he's the best movie Peter Parker ever.
Miles away, like none of the others, which is not saying too much because most of them
miles
sucked.
Away.
Huh. Oh, huh. God damn it. just blew everyone off the map.
Yep.
Really charming, but also does the drama well and the break points, like the
and the
crisis.
Insecurity and yeah. the courage that is driven from it. And I think that's kind of owed to the setup of the movie, which is something that hasn't been done in any of the Spider-Man origin story versions before, where here we don't have to justify Spider-Man. We know he already exists. Like Civil War showed us he exists. And yeah. the fact that he's trying to prove himself to Tony Stark here is an amazing setup because like here he has reason to doubt himself, and here he has a very clear objective and like a very interesting dynamic with Tony Stark. And when I heard like Robert Downey Jr. was apparently on set for just 3 days, and I really feared that he was going to super phone it in, right? But I think he did an amazing job here.
Yeah, he like, did a really good job.
Whatever little time they had with him was super well utilized. And beyond yeah. that, like even when he's not there, you feel his presence because it's like so ingrained into the nature of the film.
I agree. And then the second thing here, Michael Keaton.
Oh my God. He was so good.
God, he fucking, where has this been in the last few years? Like, he's a good actor, but
Beyond
he's never,
Birdman. Birdman.
Beyond Birdman. Amazing. Yeah. Wait, Birdman? And now he's playing a bird-like
yeah,
villain.
Yeah, I know, right? Right?
He has a bird thing. Wow. He just fucking knocked it out of the park. And
he's the best Marvel villain so far in the movies.
I agree wholeheartedly. And the villain himself is so fucking cool, and they never call him the Vulture.
Yeah.
Just no, at the end on the note.
Yes, exactly that. I was gonna
yeah,
say
but
that.
That's genius, though, because the entire movie, they don't call him the Vulture. And then on the note,
yeah,
brilliant.
On the origin of the villain, like I really loved that it felt very street level, and we saw the like repercussions of the big Avengers stuff. Like the origin of the villain comes from Avengers and the havoc they wreaked over the city. And yeah. like throughout the movie, you constantly see these hints of the larger world and how the lives of more ordinary people are affected by this. Like the Captain America instructional videos were amazing.
Yeah. And that ties really well with Civil War, which
yeah.
that was like the overlay, the oversight, the bird's eye view of the problem. And then Spider-Man showed you the actual repercussions,
yeah.
the day-to-day stuff that happens. So
and that's like Hannibal Buress' character says, that guy's a war criminal, but whatever.
Yeah. yeah.
And then Buress is great, by the way.
The third thing I really love, and this is a personal thing that people might not be as excited for, I just love the idea of augmented humans versus mid-tier superheroes.
Yep.
So Spider-Man isn't Vision, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's not even Captain America, right? Captain America is comparable in ways, but he's not Iron Man and he's not Thor. So when you put him up against augmented humans, they can kick his ass.
Yeah.
Right? They can cause him severe harm and maybe even defeat him. Mm-hmm. And they did the whole augmentations thing really cool. The gadgets were amazing
and
really
like,
really fun.
They felt like believable in the setting. It didn't feel like, oh, you know, I just invented nanomachines and then now I'm like invincible or whatever.
Yeah. And by the way, there's like hints for hardcore fans because you know which Infinity Stone this stuff comes from,
mm-hmm.
and the powers are kind of in sync with what the Infinity Stone does. So that was really really clever. Everything but the shocker, but that's where they actually use it as a power source, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was done really well. And the whole crew, you know, the engineer who keeps going about the high altitude vacuum
yep.
ceiling, and the super, you know, what's the name? Bravado, the first shocker, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy who inherits him. Really, really well done. Really
Donald
well fleshed
Glover
out.
Donald Glover was amazing too. By
oh,
the
yeah.
way.
Donald Glover was great. That was really good. Kind of like his Atlanta role in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like a down on his luck kind of dude trying to survive. So that was a really good casting.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a ton of other good things like the flip they did with MJ.
Yes.
It's such a good reference to the comics because in the comic books, Mary Jane is always more socially aware than Peter Parker. Mm-hmm. And he always laughs at her for it. Like, oh, whatever with your protests and your, you know, being like a lorette and whatever, like a valedictorian, right? Fuck mm-hmm. that shit. I'm Spider-Man. And then in the movie, they completely flipped it. It's cool that she's like that. It's cool that she's like a social justice warrior and she's aware of these kind of things.
And also, like, in general, all the kids were awesome.
Yeah.
And also, you know, all the teenagers actually felt like teenagers, both in terms of the age of the actors
yeah.
and also the writing of the characters.
100%. And like that thing with the Washington Monument,
mm-hmm.
that quip about it being built by slaves. It
yeah.
was, there was so much potential for cringe there.
Yep.
And so much potential to just fuck it up, but he did it really fucking well. And I could just keep going. Like the action scenes were really good.
Yeah. One the editing was surprisingly good for like yeah. being such a blockbuster. Like I also saw Baby Driver this week.
Oh, I need to see that.
And I had very high, so it's a good movie. But I had way too high expectations and it didn't feel Edgar Wright enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like very editing aware when I went to this movie. And there were some really interesting editing decisions that I really appreciated.
Interesting. So, and one thing I want to say about the action scenes, one thing I really, really liked is all the moves were super Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very Spider-Man moves. And they did the signature uppercut.
Yep.
Where he webs someone, pulls him into him, and then uppercuts him.
Yep.
That's like the Spider-Man move, and they saved it for the last fight scene. And that's really, really, really clever, because people are expecting it.
Yep.
People see it coming, but then you delay it, and when it comes, it's so satisfying.
And also, what was I going to say? God damn it, I was just going to make a good point, but I fucking forgot.
The suit AI.
The suit AI was great.
Incredible like, comic relief.
The fact that he's like an amateur and he fails, like him having to run across the golf field because there's nothing to swing from.
Yeah. And like, we're getting into super small stuff. The coding OS looked like an actual coding program.
Yes.
And it wasn't like, blah, 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 I'm hacking into the mainframe. And like, when they want to hack into the suit, they have to USB into
yeah.
it. Like, it has a port. And then when he wants to deactivate the protocol, yeah, it's two clicks because deactivating shit in code is like a click, right?
Yeah.
You press Y and enter and then it works, right?
Yeah.
If you're messing with software that's already running and written. So that was like a small thing. I was looking at it and I was like, oh shit, that actually looks like a terminal. And so that was cool.
I feel like there's one significant spoiler in the movie, and it actually totally caught me off guard.
Spoil it, because I'm not sure what you're talking about.
No, I don't want to spoil it for the listener, but like, you know, when, okay, so in, you know, in those, in these types of movies, the last act is usually kind of, spearheaded by the villain making like one final push, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
There's a moment where like he's down on his luck, and then, but the situation seems rather resolved, right? You're like, okay, now he's out of it. Like, there's, then how are we going to pull him back in? And like that usually involves the villain kind of kidnapping someone close to the character, or like killing someone or doing something, right? And the way that twist, that was amazing.
Yeah, that was amazing. It was really well used. I also didn't really see it coming. Yeah. I had my suspicions, but I wasn't like, oh yeah. Usually Marvel movies are kind of easy to see. Yeah.
And then the scenes right after it were super great. Like the back and forth.
The car scene.
Yeah. Yeah. Man.
Yeah, really, really
good. It was so good. I mean, I'm surprised. Really, I was expecting it to be pretty cool. Like, I was expecting something along the lines of Ant-Man, maybe.
Yeah. And it was much better than Ant-Man.
This, I think, so, in the recent years, due to the amount of superhero movies, we've kind of moved away from the old school superhero movie formula of, like, you know, origin story, some down-to-earth stuff, and then, like, some ending, right? And this went back to the, like, basic formula of superhero movies, but it had enough twists in it, and it was so well done that it felt totally fresh.
And I like there's that. No origin story.
And the ending fight wasn't some big, like, you know...
New York getting destroyed.
Yeah. And, like, it just felt so good. Like, I would say that this might even be my, like, favorite... upbeat superhero movie, because I feel like there's like several genres of superhero movie. Like Logan and like the Nolan Batman stuff are at the cream of the crop for the grimdark stuff. Whereas on the happy stuff, this is, I would say, maybe my favorite.
Yeah, I agree. From the lighthearted superhero movies, this one is most on point.
Yeah.
So before we close off, I want to bring up another topic.
Mm-hmm.
Ratchet and Clank.
Mm-hmm.
I finished Ratchet and Clank. And it's a really good game.
To be clear, he's talking about the PlayStation 4 remake of the original Ratchet and Clank.
Yes, yes. It's really good for a few reasons. And the main one that I want to point out, just because I really didn't expect it to be true, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's actually well written. The jokes are all corny dad jokes, but it really owns it. And it doesn't feel tailored towards children, right? It's goofy and it's funny and there's lots of physical comedy. But it's done in a really, really cool way. And even if when it's not comedy, when it's just dialogue, it's really well written. I cared about the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's surprising, considering one of them is like a fox or whatever.
Yeah. And in these types of games, the characters can often feel very throwaway.
Yeah, like, I don't care about Rayman. It's a great game, but not because I care about Rayman, because he's whatever. And then they kept and refreshed all the great elements of the first game, which is the crazy weapons. Like you have a disco ball that makes your enemies dance, and then they're more vulnerable to your attacks, and all these like crazy, you know, that you have the robots, Mr. Zircon, and he floats next to you and kills people, and he has really good voice lines, about how he only likes to kill and shit like that. And the weapons are really, really, really cool. And then the game design itself is almost always on point. Some levels are like, you don't know, it's difficult because you can't figure out where you need to go, because the level design isn't, you know, obvious enough.
And it's also kind of old school because, you know, it's just a shot-for-shot remake of the original, almost.
Yeah, but if you play on the hardest difficulty, the combat can be very challenging. It becomes kind of like a bullet hell, and you need to dodge a lot of stuff at the same time, and you really need to use different weapons. If you just pick your favorites and play just them, you won't be able to finish the game. You have to be varied, and you have to be smart about your upgrades. There's apparently like an NG Plus mode, like a challenge mode, where you can get super advanced versions of your weapons. So I need to check that out. But yeah, I'm super pleased. Oh, and the last thing, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it looks amazing.
The graphics and the design of the levels, there's always stuff happening in the background. Like you're part of a bigger war. So there's always like people off in the distance, you know, spaceships exploding and towers falling and shit like that. It's really, really, really well done. I expected to enjoy it, but not to enjoy it as much as I did.
So, I have two quick things to mention that are kind of relevant. Since, like, this is a, you know, pretty and good remake of a whimsical old game, the Crash Bandicoot remasters are out, and I'm very happy with them. They're amazing. I just wanted to quickly say that. I'll talk about it more next week when we have more time.
Sure.
But you also mentioned this being, like, the, I mean, not, you mentioned, like, this type of thing being aimed for children. And on the episode where we had Colin and we discussed anime, and we had griped about how Western animation is either humorous or geared towards children, and, like, we lamented about how there's nothing else. Well, good news! On Netflix, now there is the Castlevania animation.
Yes, written by Warren Ellis.
Written by Warren Ellis, helmed by Adi Shankar, has Richard Armitage and a few other amazing voice actors. It's super cool, and it's very serious and very grim dark and very brutal, and great. So it's just four episodes of 25 minutes, and it feels really short, but I found this out. Apparently, Warren Ellis talked about this a long time ago, and he said that he always wanted to make one, but his original plan was to make a trilogy of movies, right? And but clearly, this is the first movie just split up into four parts, and it just got renewed for a second season of 8 episodes, and those are clearly going to be the second and third movies.
So what I'm saying, I just want to say something about Warren Ellis. You know, I'm a huge, huge Warren Ellis fan. He made Transmetropolitan, which is one of my favorite comic book series. And as you go through his career, this kind of move from really expansive and long stuff into more modular things is really indicative of his entire career. So it's not surprising to me that this is the format he chose to...
I think this is also a little bit kind of imposed by Netflix as well. I think Netflix series do better than Netflix movies.
Yeah, I agree. And
yeah, it's really cool. I heavily recommend it. And, you know, support serious Western animation. I think that's important.
I still haven't watched it, but I'm obviously going to watch it because Warren Ellis. And I'm looking forward to it.
And one last thing, looking forward to, I mentioned this to you, but before Spider-Man, they played a teaser for Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Did you?
Did that play for you as well? No, because I'm in a trash hole.
Yeah. So this was the opening few minutes of the movie, and let me just describe it to it. All of this is scored to David Bowie's Space Oddity. It starts in the present time, and it's like a kind of a time lapse. So you see something like a new module being attached to the space station, and astronauts greet each other. Like, it's Russian astronauts greeting Chinese astronauts or something like that. And it, like, jumps forward 10 years, you know, two more models attach, and it, you know, shows different ethnicities of astronauts greeting each other, hugging each other. And, like, again, it's, since it's scored, there's no dialogue. It's scored to Space Oddity, and it's kind of like a time lapse. And then, like, you know, jumps forward, like, 50 years, and you see, like, more extravagant-looking astronauts kind of greeting each other. Jumps forward, like, another 50 years, and you see an alien ship, and it's, like, first contact with aliens, and they're greeting each other. And, like, keeps jumping forward, and you see more and more wilder and bizarre aliens, like jellyfish aliens and, like, robot aliens and such. And, like, it jumps forward hundreds of years at the end. It's this huge thing, right? Because keep attaching modules. And it shows, like, the Galactic Council leader or whatever. And he says, you know, this station has become too large. It is now, like, threatening Earth's gravity and being threatened by Earth's gravity. So we will embark on a journey to find a new home for ourselves. And this giant station takes off. Like, all the mini stations have engaged their thrusters, and it goes into deep space. And that's where it ends. And that's where, like, Space Oddity culminates. And it was fucking amazing. Like, the CGI looked great. The directing, the pacing was great. The music was, of course, perfect choice. Like, it felt so good. And I'm so excited for this movie to be good.
I just need this movie to be good, please. Yes. We haven't had a good space opera after The Fifth Element. There just hasn't been a good space opera movie. And not only that, there's been some fucking terrible ones. Like
Jupiter Ascending. God damn it.
And obviously, not in your opinion, but in my opinion, the Star Wars movies. I still haven't seen Rogue One, by the way.
You liked Episode 7.
The Force Awakens?
Yeah.
I was okay with it. I didn't like it.
Guardians of the Galaxy movies are also pretty cool. But they don't feel like space opera. They feel like like, because of the Marvel connection, you know, you can't really call it a space opera. But, like, the second one was pretty legitimately space opera.
I think the first one is actually more space opera than the second one.
Sure,
you have the whole head civilization that live in the giant head. That was super space opera.
Yeah, and true.
Very Valerian as well. Like, the hub of commerce and shit like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm talking about full-on space opera.
I agree.
Right? And I just really need this movie to be good. And everybody around me is like, this is going to be another Jupiter Ascending.
Yes.
This is going to suck again. And I was so hyped for Jupiter Ascending because the trailers were great and everything looked okay and the casting was good. But then we got Eddie Redmayne whispering for the entire movie.
It was literally the same thing three times over.
Yeah, and like the bees recognizing divinity and what the fuck was that movie? Even when watching that train wreck of a movie, there were some really cool ideas in there.
Yep.
Like the anti-grav boot fight. That was really fucking cool. So again, just please, Valerian, please, Luc Besson, you've made some really terrible movies, but you've also made some really amazing movies. I'll forgive Lucy. Forgive you, Lucy. If this movie is good, I'll let you have that one.
This was so promising. Please be good.
Yeah, God. Okay, guys.
And by the way, licensing Space Oddity is actually very difficult.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, the rights to that song are notoriously messy. So that they went for it and got it is saying, you know, they care.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Goodbye. This is Ground Control to Major Tom.
Bye. Oh, wow. We're going to get sued. Bye, guys. Bye.